Okay, so if you'd like to get yourself comfortable, in a minute or so, we'll start this evening's talk. And for once, I decided what I'm going to talk about even this morning. So this evening's talk is going to be on superstition. And one of the reasons they like to get yourself nice and comfy. One of the reasons for that is that, it's getting a busy time of the year for monks, just because people are inviting you to go into this ceremony and that ceremony and all sorts of other ceremonies. And they said, well, one of the ceremonies I'm going to on Sunday, we're only taking two monks to this blessing ceremony. He said, oh, no, you've got to go three monks. Two monks is unlucky. And I said, no, that's not the case. Because different cultures have different lucky numbers. It's true that in Thailand, well, in my basic training, you never go to a ceremony with an even number of monks. You don't go with two or four or six or eight. It always has to be an odd number, because that is lucky. But that's only for Thais. In other countries, other places are like even numbers. And anyway, when I remember going with Ajahn Chah, and he is the expert as far as I was concerned, but sometimes we go to these big ceremonies and one of the monks wouldn't turn up. So there was, say, only eight monks instead of the required nine. I always thought eight was a lucky number, eightfold path. But no. They needed nine. So what do you do? Ajahn Chah said, well, the Buddha's number nine. The nice thing was, because the Buddha said it, or because, no, Ajahn, not Buddha, but the Ajahn Chah said it, people would accept that. And if I said it, they'd say, no, we're another monk, or one of you have to get out. So it's only seven. Bad. So, but anyway, just, there was no lucky or unlucky there. They got some monks there doing some chanting. That by itself is lucky. So you don't have to worry too much about all these numbers. Another example is the Friday the 13th. Because I knew I was going to give this talk tonight, I actually looked up in the Wikipedia to try and find out why is Friday the 13th unlucky. Have you heard that Friday the 13th is unlucky? No one knows why, but apparently in some countries it's not Friday the 13th, it's Tuesday the 13th is the unlucky day. Not Friday. And I say Friday the 13th became unlucky about 100 years ago. Before then it was Tuesday the 13th or Tuesday the 7th or whatever. I don't know what is an unlucky number. But I know personally that Friday the 13th is a very lucky number for me. You know why? Because I always, if it's at all possible, if I'm going overseas, I really try to get my flight on Friday the 13th. It's much cheaper and there's more space. And it's quite safe. I've never had any problem with that. So sometimes, you know, look at some of the rituals we have and the superstitions. Is it really bad luck or is it not bad luck? Look at your life. What does happen, though, is if you really believe it's bad luck, then sometimes you make it bad luck. Some reason or another, you think it's bad luck, and so, oh my goodness, Friday the 13th, going only 4 months. Well, look, let's say another bad luck. I was told, when I was over in Thailand doing the basic training, I was told it's really bad luck in your temple if you have a Buddha statue and it's not facing east. You look in Thailand and many other countries like Sri Lanka, I think the same, most of those Buddha statues face eastwards. Which way is that one facing? That's why we get all the trouble in this place. And that happened, well, more recently than Bodhinyana Monastery. Bodhinyana Monastery was our first monastery. And actually we had the 37th anniversary of Bodhinyana Monastery on December the 1st. That's when we bought that place. 37 years ago, we bought that place, and as soon as possible, someone gave a big Buddha statue. We said, put the Buddha statue, and built a hall around the Buddha statue. That's our main hall. And you know that Buddha statue? Which way is that facing? West. It faces west. And of course, I was safe at that time because there was another monk who was my boss at the time, so he put it facing west. And no one said anything. No one said anything until a senior monk from Thailand came. And as soon as the senior monk came, he was just chatting with people and said, I don't know, how is it, what's it like, how are things going in sort of Australia? And one of them said, Venerable Sir, this monk was called Ajahn Jun, I remember the time. They asked this monk, Ajahn Jun, said, Venerable Sir, so your Western disciples, they don't know anything about Buddhism. They got the Buddha statue facing the wrong way. They complained. They never complained to us directly, but they complained, when a visiting senior monk came. You know what this monk said? This is actually the real forest tradition. He said, how long has it been facing that way? Oh, a couple of years. A couple of years. If the Buddha wasn't happy, he would have turned around by himself. And that solved everything. Now, that is the answer to superstition. Somebody who is wise enough to say, well, if you can face west, fine, but it doesn't have to be. Can that hall in Bodhinyana Monastery, that must, how many years is that? That's probably about 34, 35 years or something. No, because that was when they got the land. It didn't come with a hall. When we bought the land down there, it never came with a Buddha statue. That was extra. So anyway, and that's been, I think most people can admit that. Where's Dennis at the back? Is he still there, Dennis? Oh, there he is. You see, you've been almost from the very beginning a successful monastery. There you see, because the Buddha was facing the right way. But also, it's not just which it's not just which way the Buddha is facing. It's just all the incredible stuff which has gone on in that hall over the last 37 years, or 34 years, whatever it's been built. All the great meditation, and all of the other things I'm not sure if you've seen in that hall. In the front is a Buddha statue there. There's also a little small Buddha statue. I remember when somebody came in and saw it for the first time, a little small Buddha statue, a white Buddha statue in front of the big dark Buddha statue. He said, oh, the Buddha's had a baby. Not a baby, it's just a smaller sized Buddha, that's all. But anyway, you also see this. Is that bad superstition to make jokes like that? No, it's not, because it's done with respect and to make the talk interesting. But also in front of that, we have these little containers which are supposed to be very superstitious. Because in those we have relics, Buddha relics. What do you think about those? Is that part of Buddhism and part of the training? Can you justify having Buddha relics there? Because as many people say, if you've got all the Buddha relics in all the Buddhist temples throughout the world, you know what's coming next, don't you? There'll be this huge mountain of relics, much more than can ever get from a cremation. Where do they all come from? For many, many years, I've got to say my background, I was a theoretical physicist. That's hard-nosed scientist from Cambridge University. We didn't believe in that sort of rigmarole and idle belief. But then you start to see things with your own eyes, which are weird. And one of these stories there that I think many of you know, for those early years here in Perth, really busy building Bodhinyana Monastery, like with my hands, just laying the bricks and the tiles and everything up there. And anyway, I was working so hard that the other monk who was with me, Ajahn Chakra, suggested, look, we should go and take some R&R, just a bit of a rest. So there was a lady down in Margaret, no, not Margaret River, in Manjimup, just outside the mansion, but she had a son. The son was going to be there looking after me. I had a little hut in the forest there, which I could stay in for about a week. It was a wonderful little place where I could just relax. And so I was relaxing down there, just meditating and catching up on some sleep and eating food and not doing anything else. I was banned from building anything. But then in the evening, she gave me a cup of tea and just chatting, and she said this story that this very, very good monk, and I love this monk, I've mentioned his name a couple of times in Bodhidharma Monastery the last week. His name was Ajahn Tate, T-A-T-E. And there's two reasons I really was very inspired by this monk, Ajahn Tate. This is personal anecdotes. When I first went to Bangkok 46 years ago, that this monk, he was in hospital with cancer, and he was dying. Looked after by the king of Thailand at the time, and so he got every best possible medical attention he could get. But then in the hospital, the doctor said, there's nothing more we can do. You're going to die. Can't do any more treatment for your cancer. And so he said, well, if I'm going to die, I don't want to die in Bangkok. I'll go back to my monastery and die there. It's beautiful monasteries on the banks of the Mekong River, just upstream from Nong Khai. Not Nong Khai, yeah. No, further north. No, that was Nong Khai, sorry. And he said, I'd rather die there. So he got taken up to this monastery to die. And about 25 years later, he finally died. I went to see him a couple of times before he passed away. He's a wonderful monk. He was a monk, right? I told the other monks this. I'm not quite sure how much you can understand this little anecdote, but it just really moved me enormously and solved many other questions I had about meditation, about Dhamma. When I made an appointment to see him, because he was very famous at this time, not only just surviving cancer, but a very great meditator and very wise person. And now, even me, I was maybe 8 years as a monk, 7 years as a monk. Even I had to put my name down on a list and wait in line. And I had these questions. I only have about 10 or 15 minutes to ask these questions, which had always really I wanted to ask from a monk who was very, very highly attained. Have you ever thought like that? To have just personal one-on-one and with your questions, and you could really ask them. And finally my chance came, and I went into the room and saw this monk who was just so physically small, but spiritually a giant. And as soon as I saw him and he looked at me, every question I ever had just evaporated. And my mind was so incredibly still. He zapped me with something. I don't know what it was, but it was nice. And then I was sitting there just dumbfounded. Not a thought in my mind. And he was looking at me. And then afterwards I said, well, I didn't have any questions. But my thought which came up next was, they're going to have to get, because they didn't have tractors in that part of Thailand, a dozen water buffalo to drag me out in chains. I'm not leaving. Because it was just a beautiful experience. And I often contemplated that afterwards. That particular monk had just zapped me with so much loving kindness and peace. When my mind became so still, every question I ever had just totally vanished. And you're so peaceful, content, and happy with everything. It was from experiences like that I realized what questions really came from a mind which was disturbed. When the mind isn't disturbed, there are no questions. You have all the answers. You're all right there. So anyway, that was this wonderful, wonderful, wonderful monk. But anyway, he actually came to Australia before I arrived here. One of the first great monks to come to this part of Western Australia. And he gave these little Buddha relics to this lady because she was such a good Buddhist. She was Australian. And anyway, she said she received three tiny little Buddha relics, just three. And she split with her husband, so she was staying alone with her son. And she told me that she had to get a contractor in to do some renovations or to cleaning in her main room. And the contractor afterwards told her, when he finished a couple of days' work, he said, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry, but when I was doing the work, I knocked over your shrine." And she looked and two of her relics had disappeared. She only had one left. And she said to me at the time that that really sort of hurt her, that she was entrusted with these relics, which she believed in 100%, and she'd lost two of them. And what she'd done afterwards was, it was in the countryside, so they don't have a rubbish service there. Everything goes on the compost pile. And she knew where she'd vacuumed the carpet, and she knew roughly where she'd put that compost. And so she spent a couple of months with a tea strainer, straining all the compost, until she could actually find one of those relics which would be missing. So she found one, but she was still missing one. When I went, she told me that story. It was a lot of sadness that, you know, she hadn't looked after something which she should have done. And I can't really blame her because it wasn't her fault. The contractor, you know, should have been a bit more careful. But anyway, when she was telling me this story, I said, "When was the last time you had a look in the little container?" She said, "Oh, about 3 or 4 months ago." "Let's have another look." And I only tell this story because, you know, it was wonderful, it was magical. She gave me the container, I opened it. Count. 1, 2, 3. It had come back. And these are things which, you know, I see with my own eyes. It had returned. And she was so taken up by that. She went down to her desk and wrote it all out on a piece of paper to say just what had happened. And of course, some of you don't believe such stuff. Some of Ajahn Vaz is being superstitious again. But there was a, because I travel around a lot and I'm quite well known now, that I was in, I think Malaysia. No, it must have been Thailand, I think. And a Burmese monk came to see me. And he said he's spending all his life, you know, many years going into the jungles of Burma, where he said that every now and again he finds his old stupas, his reliquaries, which had been taken over by the jungle and fallen over, and see if he can find any relics which aren't being looked after in those old monuments. And he told me that he travelled to one remote village in northern Burma, and he'd been told by the villagers that one villager had inexplicably become wealthy. So he knew probably what had happened. He asked the villager, and the villager wouldn't say anything, until eventually the monk said, "Look, I don't want any money from you. I don't, you know, want to take away whatever you found. I just want to know if where you found that, whatever it was, whether there's any relics in there, little bones, fragments of the Buddha." And eventually he said that he'd gone into the jungle searching for mushrooms or whatever, or herbs or whatever he was looking for, and came across an old monument which had been fallen over because the jungle had taken over, and he found a golden casket in there with some bones in it. He threw away the bones, took the casket, because you could sell that for money, that's where he got his money from. And the monk said, "Look, please, I don't want anything except those bones in the casket." So the man took him back to that monument, and they found many of the bones. He said, "I don't want the casket, you can keep that, I just want the bones." And many of those bones, that monk collected, and then he put in nice little containers, and he gave to me. He said, "Ajahn Brahm, you're doing a good job in Australia, and I want to give these to help Buddhism in Western Australia." So he gave me these bones, Buddha relics, and his caskets, which he managed to get from his donors, to bring back to Australia. Now, I went via Singapore, and I left some of those relics in Singapore, and I brought the rest home here. And that was always a wonderful experience, which I'll never forget, is bringing these relics through the customs in Perth Airport. Because, you know, many of you got good memories because you can't go travelling right now, but they have these customs declaration cards and, you know, what you're carrying with you. And, you know, so I was on the aircraft and what can I say? And as a monk, you have to be honest. That's, you know, we give other people precepts, the five precepts, and it's so important that we're honest too. So I put it down under human bones. That's what they are. So I said human bones. And so, of course, I declared them. I said, yeah, I've got some human bones here. And, of course, you know, they don't just wave you through. They said, okay, let's have a look. And they were in these beautiful containers. And they said, what type of bones are these? They're the bones of the Lord Buddha. I said. And the poor guy's face said, too difficult for me. I've got to get the boss, you know, the one in charge. Apparently, they have these programs now that on the TV. You can see what happens in customs. I wish they'd have got that. That would have been a bestseller. That would be so wonderful if we could have a record of that. But anyway, I said, the Buddha's bones. And the guy came out and looked at it. And he said, oh, crikey, this is way too difficult for me, said the boss. He said, get out of here. And so I came out with my relics. It just shows you, like, honesty. This honesty and sincerity. I said, look, I'm not going to catch anything from this. I'm not going to sell anything from this. These are just relics. And so anyway, he let me through. And some of those relics are now in the hall. But the ones which I left in Singapore, the people in Singapore, the Buddhist Fellowship, that these are all highly educated, you know, university graduates, business people, and they accepted that. They can see when I accepted the relics, they weren't so convinced that this was anything important. But then they put them in their place. And I always remember, just about a week later, I got an email back, Ajahn Brahm. You only gave us two, these relics. There are now three. They multiplied. You asked the people in the Buddhist Fellowship who were on that committee at the time. They did. That's impossible. But they saw it. It happened. So anyway, there's plenty of things like that happen, which really make a theoretical physicist sort of start to, what the heck's going on here? It only happens when people have got a little bit of confidence or they need to see something which is really important to them. So anyway, that's with the relics. But the problem sometimes is that people feel that that's all you need to do. Superstition, just get a few relics and then you can be very wealthy. No way. Even to the point that, of course, I haven't really checked this out, but people told me that sometimes in the armies in Thailand, many hundreds of years ago, they would actually sometimes put relics in the spears or in the banners which they would go into war with so they could defeat the enemy. And I thought, that's really going a bit too far. That's not what relics are supposed to be used for. But put them in a shrine like you have in Bodhidharma Monastery. And that gives a lot of power to that place. Even though, you know, sometimes say, why? I don't know if any of you are superstitious enough to believe in Feng Shui. Do you believe in Feng Shui? One of the people over here, he told me his Feng Shui story. He was having a trouble with his marriage. It happens. And so he didn't know what to do. He went through the usual processes of marriage counselling and stuff, but then he saw a Feng Shui expert. Well, his wife was away somewhere. And Feng Shui said, it's your furniture in your house is really badly positioned. He said, that's causing, you know, the marriage problems. And he told me, he said, after he heard that and he took action, all the problem totally faded away. He solved his marriage problem. He said, well, how do you rearrange it? He said, well, when my wife was out shopping, I put all the furniture against the front door. Now there's no more problem. So that's today's joke. But anyway,
I think you're superstitious enough to know there's always one coming every week. But anyway, in Bodhinana Monastery, when I wasn't there, somebody, they brought this feng shui expert, I mean, a really top one from, you know, Asia somewhere. And, you know, they take him to our monastery, have a look, something to do. There's not much to look at in Western Australia. But, you know, our monastery, if you're into that sort of thing, that was really a nice place to go to. And he went in there. And apparently the woman who was his disciple just told me, just absolutely honestly, he went inside your hall, he was blown away. So the feng shui, the energy in the front of that meditation hall is huge. It's not so big in the back, but in the front, whoa, it's really big. And many of you who've been on retreats in Bodhinyana Monastery have gone to visit and sat meditation in the front of that hall. That is powerful in there. Why? Buddha's facing the wrong way. But nevertheless, so much energy in there. Not only just for, I must admit, it's not only just from those relics, it's also from all the great monks and nuns and people who have been meditating in that hall over so many years. You can actually feel energy in there. I can, I'm sure that you can as well. But anyway, there are some places it's so easy to meditate, sometimes it's so hard. It's just the spiritual energy is huge in that place. Even I notice that and love meditating there. But anyway, so is this superstition or what is it? Now, for me, it doesn't really matter superstition, why it works. The point is it does work sometimes. And that's one of the reasons why. If it does work, make use of it. Why it works, why it doesn't work, who knows? It's one of the reasons why when people come with superstition, they ask for pirit chanting or pirit thread. This is my pirit thread story. The pirit thread, has anyone got any string on their hands? You know, the white string? None of you. Oh, you got some? Yeah, you got some white string on here. The white string. Where did that come from? Why do we put, in some traditions, we put this white string on people's hands in Buddhism? Is that superstitious or what is it? But my story, for good luck, but where does that good luck come from? Why? But anyhow, my story. True story, verified, that many years ago, I was on duty here in Nollumbara for the weekend. Saturday morning, just after lunch. Well, it must have been, it wasn't after lunch, it was actually just a bit later than that. Oh no, it was, about 1 or 2 o'clock. Anyway, these Sri Lankan boys came. He said, yeah, what do you want? He said, you may know, actually I didn't know, but I found out later it was true, that there was a cricket match on in the Wacker. It was a one-day international match between Sri Lanka and Australia. Sri Lankan cricket team were in town. And the Sri Lankan team were being hammered by Australia. And at the half-time, the lunch break, the Sri Lankan team were doing so badly, they said, is there any monk anywhere to get some holy string from, you know, to try and, you know, help our performance? And so I remember cricket. I used to, you know, go to, when I was at Cambridge, just go very short distance to watch the people play cricket. It was really good fun. So, you know, those days, you can go in there and you just need to pay anything. I was poor and see these great cricketers, you know, playing. But anyway, I love cricket, watching it, not playing it. I was never really competitive to actually play sport. I love watching it, though. But anyway, so I knew what cricket was. So anyway, that when they asked for some string, I gave them 12 pieces. Because, you know, 11 people play cricket, but they also got the 12th man. So I always remember that. So I gave them 12 pieces, blessed it and everything. And they sort of, apparently they all put it on. But that afternoon, they still did terribly. They lost to Australia. Really big. Never mind. But that was only a warm-up game. Because the big competition happened about 6 weeks later. World Cup cricket. And it was played in India and Sri Lanka. And of course, you may know that the Indians and Sri Lankans, cricket is, it's not a matter of life and death. It's much more important than that. That was taken out from Bill Shankly. I'm sorry, Bill.
But anyway, that they really got into that. And of course, the final of the World Cup. What year was that? 96. The final of the World Cup was between Australia and Sri Lanka. And what happened? You ask any Sri Lankan. Even if they didn't like cricket, they liked cricket that day because Sri Lanka won. It was the first major international competition that Sri Lanka won. They won the World Cup. And oh, the whole of Sri Lanka was just rejoicing. Even over here they were rejoicing. And even over here in the front page of the West Australia, the big picture of their captain, Arjuna Ranatunga. Well, actually, I saw him when he was when I was in Sri Lanka some years ago. Checked it out. Yes, true. He had the World Cup, holding it up, delighted, with the crowds going mad, except for the Australians. They were really fed up. And you could see on his hand, my string. That was the reason why Australia lost. And I said to many people, I kept that quiet for many years. But I know how Australia love cricket as well. And if they'd have found out why they lost the World Cup, or they'd have taken away my passport, you know, they can do these days, and exiled me to somewhere. But anyhow, is that superstition or what is it? Sometimes it works. Why? You know that sometimes the reason why it works is because you do some trying to give some string or give some relics or do something. The very least, the very minimum, it just encourages people, it uplifts people. It gives people extra energy, extra positivity. And ask any psychologist, you know that when you make people have some extra positive psychology, that really helps them succeed, get over problems in life, give them some energy to do better things in life. It is why, you know, the days when if you ever watch sport or something, you get on the lines, on the outside the lines watching, you start cheering your team, come on, you can do it, yes, you can do it, why not, yeah. If you get people cheering for you, that makes you play better. But sometimes you get so much encouragement from others that sometimes that makes you do much better than you could ever do by yourself. And sometimes that belief, that encouragement, the psychological boost of having some string on your wrist, having some chanting, having something which uplifts you. How else do you know, in my life, some of the things which I've seen, which is, you know, did that happen? It did. These are the times when they just go and do some chanting for people who are really sick. I mean really sick, like dying in hospital. Whew. Sometimes you ask the nurse, you say, well, you can do some chanting, but there's not much hope for the person. You do some really strong chanting, because I've got a strong mind, okay? You know, it's not through willpower, it's making it very peaceful and getting the energy coming up and zapping people. Some of the people I've zapped in the ICU, they open their eyes, get better. Weird. But, you know, you've seen it enough times to wonder, what the heck's going on here? I don't know how it works, but I know it does, and that's enough for me. So, encouragement, or is it energy just going from one person to another? There's something there, which is why that just to rely 100% totally on that is obviously very, very wrong. And I think I told this story a couple of weeks ago, but absolutely true. There's a Malaysian girl, UWA. She came to see me just before the exams, end of year exams at UWA. I said, Bob, can you please do some blessing for me? I'll do my exams next week. Yeah, sure. So I gave her a nice chanting. And she said, I never saw her again. Never. I saw her friends, and she said, that girl's going around saying Ajahn Brahm's not a good monk. Because she failed. And she blamed me for the chanting. And the girl said, don't worry, Ajahn Brahm, because she had not done the homework, not gone to lectures. She'd be a party girl. And she expected me to take care of the important part of being at university. The studies, there's only a certain amount. But, of course, you can uplift with some of this. So, like, what's the other thing which we do? You've seen me do this before. I don't do it, you know, in this room over here. But you've seen myself and Ajahn Ajahn Brahm used to do as well, but also I, Hasapanya, doing the holy water. Sprinkling people with holy water. Is that superstitious? Is it? You ask any of the kids. Because you know sometimes, if you're a kid coming to a temple, it's as boring as hell. I mean, they can't understand dependent origination. Sometimes there's some special kids, I remember, just sometimes there's one child who came years ago, 7 years of age, and she was such a good meditator. Well, honestly, probably better than half of the people in this room right now. She was always really calm and peacefully. And of course she carried on, she still comes. I won't say who it is, and that was maybe 25 years ago now. Love it. She's a natural meditator. Great, come in, be really peaceful. But anyway, some of the holy water stuff, you do that on kids, and they come to the temple, they love it. They burst out laughing, they have a great time. And sometimes I feel that is also valuable. You know, not just coming here just to learn something, not just coming in here to sort of develop deeper meditation or get enlightened quickly, but just to have some welcome fun in the place. And I know that because I remember just when I was young in England going to a church, and there was no fun there at all at the time. And so just a bit of holy water on the little kids, they burst out laughing and they start sort of squealing, which means they have some very positive experiences, happy experiences when they're young. And so later on they'll come back again. And many mothers have told me that they think their kid just plays around in the temple. But then the kids, it's amazing just how much they learn. So where did you learn that from? I was listening. So it's wonderful when you can make religion a little bit more acceptable, even for little kids. But anyway, with the holy water, it's very rare that Ajahn Chah would ever do that, but he did do holy water, because I remember once, and Ajahn Chah, he was visited, he was still alive, and I was a monk with him at the time, when he was visited by a big major general in the Thai army. Some of you know this story, please excuse me, but it's worth telling you again. They're already laughing, giving the game away, but you know, for those people in Thailand, like the generals have a huge amount of power. You know, they always have. So you don't mess around with a major general in the Thai army when he comes to visit you. So he came to visit with a lot of his, you know, majors and sort of colonels and stuff, a whole entourage, and he came up to see Ajahn Chah and just, you know, get a blessing, and he really wanted some holy water. You know, there's sprinkling. You've all seen us do the holy water here, haven't you? You know what I'm talking about, just a little swish, and just swish nice water on the top of a person's head. He said, I really need some holy water. And Ajahn Chah said, no, we don't do it here. He said, no, please, please, please. And it was a major general, so it put Ajahn Chah on the spot. What should I do? He said, okay, come here, I'll make it special for you. So bend your head over. So the monk was sitting on a higher seat, and the major general just bent his head over with his hands up, in great reverence. And Ajahn Chah he spat on the major general's head. Now, even doing that in Australia, you're asking for trouble. But in Thailand, I mean, the head is the top part for a person. You actually, even as a monk, you know, if I try and help you shave your head, even I've got to ask permission first of all. It's okay if I touch your head to shave it? You know, that's revere the head over there. And to spit on a general's head, I thought, Ajahn Chah's really gone too far this time. I always thought that one day he'd just push it too much. I thought that was that day. But then Ajahn Chah, he just really shocked me. You know, he took it further. He got his hand and rubbed it in. And I thought, oh no, this is the end. They're going to drag Ajahn Chah away. But that general, you can see him beaming. He was just so happy afterwards. It's special. Right from the holy monk's mouth. It's amazing, cause, and that really uplifted that general, you know, make him a better person maybe, I don't know. But anyway, I've got to do my holy water story as well. I've got time to do my holy water? Okay, here we go. So, we used to do, you know, quite strict meditation when I was in Thailand. So once a week we stay up all night meditating in the hall. And it was just, you know, after you've been meditating all night, sometimes you go into a really nice meditation, full of energy, but a lot of time you're a bit dull afterwards. So at the first light, you know, you go outside the hall to, you know, to urinate. But, you know, this, instead of going to the toilets, and this was a forest, a jungle, so you squat down. You may have seen people doing the squatting down urinating tradition, just, you know, squat down and you can urinate somewhere. And it's important to know you're squatting down, okay? And number two, it was just dawn, so it wasn't much light. And number three, I was tired. I'd been meditating. I hadn't slept all night. So, you know, very carefully, just started urinating. And it's in the forest. You know, nice and sort of healthy. And I really thought I was urinating on a stick. I'd never seen a snake start to slither like that. And I realized it wasn't a stick, it was a snake. I was urinating on a snake. A very venomous one. And the most sensitive part of my male anatomy was only a couple of inches away from its mouth. Yeah. It's only because I was really dull that I didn't scream. Because now I've been meditating all night. Oh, this is interesting. But that snake, it never bit me. It just stayed there. And I thought afterwards, why? It's very rare that a snake gets a blessing of holy water direct from a monk. But it did. So it's a very happy snake. And it's extra because most water is cold. That's nice and warm. Anyway, just the superstition. Sometimes that we believe superstition too much, but not to believe anything at all, again, is just going to another extreme. If you can use superstition wisely to encourage people, to allow people to get a bit more energy, a bit more confidence, to actually believe that something might actually happen, and then it does happen. I've seen that too many times to doubt it any longer. Well, what some people call miracles. Well, I've seen a couple of miracles in my life, and of course the one which, you know, Ajahn Bhumali, you can ask him tomorrow, Ajahn Bhumali is very, very sceptical. But there's one of those miracles he always accepts. He was there at the time, yeah, this happened, it worked. And that was the time of that 30th anniversary, remember Dennis? We had in Supreme Court Gardens. The Supreme Court Gardens flooded. It's kind of a couple of inches of water. The Kwinana Freeway flooded. But the rain started in the morning, went all day. And that was when the Premier was Jeff Gallop. And, you know, we invited him up to be the guest of honour to our big 30th anniversary ceremony of the Buddhist Society of West Australia at this place. And, you know, would you come, please? And we also had this statue behind me. It had just come from Thailand. And so we had that. We took that to the Supreme Court Gardens. Set it up in the rain. And I must admit, all our volunteers, they got soaked that night. That day, sorry. Because we're going to have the ceremony from, I think, say 7 to 8 or something. I remember three times the Premier's office, Jeff Gallup, called me. I wanted to speak to Adrian, but I'll get it from the source. He said, are you going to cancel? I said, no. Second time, rang up, are you going to cancel? No. Third time, no. And even we had a few people, they took me aside, say, Ajahn Brahm, you've got to cancel. It's going to flood. It's really heavy rain, and not just a small rainstorm, all day. And even one of the monks is not here today, but he disrobed afterwards. He took me aside, said, Ajahn Brahm, you're embarrassing us. You've got to cancel. You've got to stop. You can't do this ceremony in this heavy rain. It was a storm. It was, what's they call it, extreme weather event. So no, we're going to go ahead. And I also remember, Cherry's not here today, but some mother came into one of the tents while I was arranging something, crying her eyes out. I always remember that. Tears were coming down her face. And I thought, oh crikey, what else has gone wrong? And someone had electrocuted themselves or broken their leg or something. So I went out, feeling the worst, and she just pointed up to the sky. The clouds had parted. We had the full moon. It was Waisak Day. You could see the full moon above Supreme Court Gardens. The storm had stopped. And Jeff Gallup came. And he was really impressed. And we did the ceremony. There was a slight shower. I mean, a very tiny sprinkling. But we managed to finish the ceremony. And then, as soon as the ceremony was finished, it really bucketed down all night. And that was amazing to actually to see that, because we're doing something really amazing, that it actually happened. Big storm had stopped. And even, I just better finish off soon, even the person who hired out all of the marquees and stages and PA system and all that stuff you see in a major event, I think it was called Reese Hire, I think it was. But anyway, the managing director sent an email to me the next day. Actually, to the person who was organising that part of the event. And he said, who is this Ajahn Brahm? I don't know who he is, I don't care, but can you please ask him who is going to win the horse racing today? So he certainly believed it. Anyway, so that's a little bit about superstition. Some of it is real, some of it is not so real. So the part which is real, make use of it. Encourage yourself. And make a nice, better world. There are other beings in this universe, maybe you don't know about, who do want to help. Thank you for listening. Sadhu. Okay, get some questions, I hope. Okay, here we go. Uh-oh, no questions on it. You pressed the wrong button. Okay, here we go. 1, 2, 3, 4, I'm not too long. From Canada, from Rushika in Canada, how does one have a still mind when interacting with people, patients in a stressful scenario, like an emergency room? Thank you. It's a great question. Sometimes to be able to practice those Emperor's Three Questions, now is the only time you have. The one right in front of you is the most important person in the whole world, and the only thing to do is to care. Don't try and cure, to care. And giving importance to this moment. And after a while, this is how we train in meditation. We can really focus on the content of our present moment, no matter what it is, and really care for it. So our mind is still. It's in this moment. And you interact with the person. And sometimes, I practice this. Sometimes you come up and ask me a question, and it's a really important question. And you ask me, and I just make my mind totally still. And then see what comes up. You don't plan the answer, see what comes out of your mouth. That really is living in the moment, being very still. But also not being afraid. A lot of times fear, especially if you're with people or patients in a stressful scenario, the fear can sometimes stop you being still. So see if you can notice the fear, and just give up the fear. And trust that in that stillness is a huge amount of wisdom which can come up and is way, way, way more effective than thinking, what am I supposed to do? What would other people do? What if I do it wrong?
What would other people think of me? All of those ideas, that's what creates the stress. Trust yourself in this moment and be wonderfully caring and see what happens. J-Dog, did the Buddha tell any jokes? Yes. But sometimes they're hard to find. But you can see some. But not so joke like we tell jokes these days. But like little funny anecdotes. For example, that there was a group of practitioners in the time of the Buddha called the Jains. And the Jains had a basic idea. Of course, it's a whole huge range of different traditions which come under the umbrella of the Jains. But they used to have an idea of trying to burn off all of their bad karma by doing lots of ascetic practices. So once you've burned off all that old karma, then you'll be free of the old karma, the bad karma, then you'll be enlightened. That was their idea, in brief. So he'd sometimes see these Jains standing on one leg, just facing the sun, naked, hardly eating. And people said, what do you think about that? You know, you Buddhist monks are too fat and sort of relaxing. Said, and the Buddha said, yes, because we haven't done as much bad karma as those Jains have done. Which was, you know, pretty sort of jokey and pretty sort of sharp. Anyway, from Rucha in India, does having no dream in your life is a good thing? If you really mean like no aspiration for the future, you know, no sort of goals in your life, is that a good thing or a bad thing? It is, again, it's half and half. There are times when you have to give up all goals to have a rest, relax. So if you come to Jhana Grove Retreat Center for a retreat, please don't have any goals. Just relax. This is a no-goal zone. And see what it's like. But when you go to school, you've got to work hard to pass your exams. So you can have a goal there. You have a goal when you sort of have a committee meeting for the Buddhist Society. The goal is usually to get it over and done with as soon as possible. Oops. Oops. you know what I mean. There's times when his goals are good, but there's a lot of times no goals at all. And imagine what that's like. Have a time, you're meditating. No goal at all. I'm not trying to achieve anything. I'm trying to really relax and rest. A person has no rest, of course, you never have any joy. So, have a dream. Is dreaming your life a good thing? Sometimes. But sometimes, the dreams can very easily become nightmares. Because sometimes they don't turn out exactly the way you wanted. So sometimes, just let them all go. And have some peace. And then you can recalibrate your settings. Lastly, from Malaysia. In my culture, we believe in a third of your life is dependent on your karma, third is feng shui, and third is your action at the present moment. Is it superstitious to believe that? I am confused. I don't know. Instead of saying a third, it is some of your life on your karma. But that is actually the karma, the ingredients which you have to work with. The hand you're dealt, if you like. And what you do with that, how you play your hand, that's actually the karma of the present moment. And the feng shui as well. What is that actually feng shui situation you're in? But of course, you can always change the feng shui. You can always, as I say, rearrange the furniture so your partner can't get in the house. Or whatever it is. So some of that is important. So all of those things are important. But I always say that the feng shui in your life or your karma from the past, that's almost stuck. You can't do much about that. But what you're doing right now is what you've got. That is the most important part of life. How you're dealing with the happiness and the disappointments, the frustrations and the ease which you have in life. And we all have disappointments at times. Things don't always go right. But you know, sometimes when things go wrong in life, sometimes when things go wrong, that's when wonderful things happen. I still tell many people, I've told this before to you, that when I was 19, I fell in love
this wonderful girl. Oh, we're so much in love.
That's true.
But then, she dumped me. Thank you so much. Otherwise, I would have become a monk. So at the time you think, oh, this is terrible. But afterwards, oh, you see the benefit in it. So when things go wrong in your life, you just see the big picture. It's probably wonderful. Anyway, that wasn't feng shui. That was, probably my fault anyway. I don't know. Anyway, it happened. So anyway, that's 9 o'clock now. It's long enough. So I tried to do the best I possibly could to answer those questions. But hopefully that they were useful for you, the answers. Any questions from the floor here? Eddie, yes. Because apparently somebody said the other day, so where's Eddie's voice? They hadn't heard you for a while. Yeah. No superstition?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think it's better not to dwell with them, you know? Because if you keep following all these superstitious things, it could, certain things could be worrying thing, you know? Worrying, just what we want, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
worry, yeah. And also the Buddha was telling us in the Kalama Sutta, don't just believe, you know? Yeah.
Kalama
and also things like he was telling us, Buddha, don't dwell in the past and or the future too, you know? Because if you were to take in all these different, you know, like sources from past, future, yeah. And super, the body can't take it, you know?
Yeah.
And then it breaks down.
Well, that's
sick, you know,
it's an important point because the Buddha, they say, I think Ajahn Brahmadi, did he talk about the Kalama Sutta last week or is it this week he's talking about it? But anyway, the Kalama Sutta says that don't disbelieve it, so don't believe the Kalama Sutta. It's from the past. So anyway, yeah, any superstition or beliefs in something, they should always be tentative. Because even if you've heard it, sometimes we misunderstood it. Sometimes even if you read it in the books, have you understood it correctly and translated it accurately? So sometimes there's a lot of doubts there, but when it works, you can feel it.
Do you think it works, Adam Brown?
What?
You think superstitious?
Okay, I was going to say this story, but I didn't have time, but I'm going to say it now to end up. This is one of my family stories, told to me by my mother and my auntie. And I questioned them so much about this, to say, this can't be true. They said, yes, it was true. After the Second World War, my mother and my auntie, actually they were cousins, but they grew up as like sisters, that they're both single. And they went just for a bit of fun and games, nothing more, just to go and see a medium. You know, something to do. And this medium took one look at my aunt and said, you are soon to meet your husband, to be. She hadn't met anybody yet. And she said, oh, that's interesting, but you know, who want to believe that? And the medium said, and his name will be first name Donald, which is not an uncommon name at that time. The surname is Wolfreys. W-O-L-F-R-E-Y-S. Donald Wolfreys. That is a very uncommon name. And of course, my mother was there at the time with my auntie. And, you know, they heard that. I don't believe that. So they went away. About a week later, at a dance, you know, the old-fashioned dance, not a nightclub, nice young man came up to my auntie. Do you want to dance? Yeah, okay. And what's your name? Donald. Surname? Wolfreys. And they were married for over 60 years. She's actually amazing. She's in her 90s. She's still alive. But he died a couple of years ago. And I asked him, well, what happened? You know, when you're told you're going to marry a guy called Donald Wolfreys, and you meet a guy, and what's your name? Donald. Surname? Wolfreys. Didn't you sort of faint or something, or die of shock or something? I said, no, it's very nice. And how on earth can that happen? And all my theoretical physics, all the quantum theory I ever knew, and special relativity just cannot explain that. And that's, obviously it's a true story, because it's my own mother, and I asked about that so many times.
But the medium is not superstition, Ajahn Brahm.
It's not superstition.
Yeah, sometimes certain cultures, you know, it can sort of make
sometimes.
You know, not at ease, you know.
Sometimes they can, sometimes they can't. But anyway, what I'm saying is there's some things in life which, you know, sometimes are no explanation, but they're true. But if you just depend upon that, like many people, that they ask me just, what's the trick of becoming rich in life? And I say, can you give me some blessings to be rich? He said, no, go to work, don't spend so much. That's not what we want to hear. So that's when people just say, want to be, have an easy way. So if you are sick, yeah, just live a healthy lifestyle as best you possibly can. Go and see the doctor, do all the other things. When you can have the spirit thread as well and some chanting and holy water, whatever. But don't forget to do the other part.
Just quickly.
Yeah,
but
go
don't
on,
you
Eddie.
Think it's good to be free from all these superstitions, free from the past, the future, worrying of the future? Just be so we be a light, you know. We only deal with the present, not all this coming to overload our mind, you know.
Overload our mind. It depends. If it works, make use of it. If it doesn't, give it up. Okay.
Thank you, anyway.
Thank you, Eddie. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, let's make bow the Buddha, Dhamma, the Sangha, and then we can do what we need to do. Know that sometimes Buddhism can be very cold and intellectual if we don't have a little bit of fun and games as well. So thank you, Eddie.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhayami suvākato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi suppatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho saṅghaṃ namāmi.